Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Toldot. It means generations. It is from Genesis chapter 25, verse 19, to chapter 28, verse 9. The Haftarah is Malachi chapter 1, verses 1 to 16, and Malachi 2, verses 1 to 7. And the Brit Hadashah is Romans chapter 9, verses 1 to 31. Let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu, Melech haolam. We thank you and praise you, Abba, for you are the King of the universe. You are the Creator of all things. I just ask that you would bless your people on this Shabbat and that you would make only your words to thrive, and that if anything comes from my flesh, that it would just die. I pray these things in Yeshua's name. Amen. This is called Generations or Toldot because this is the only Torah portion in which you will find mention of all three generations of patriarchs. And it is also the one that raises so much speculation about the character and motivations of the patriarchs. Mostly the speculation in this Torah portion has to do with Isaac, as he does seem to be the center of attention this time. Let's go to Genesis 25:19. It says, "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Betuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban, the Syrian." Now, just reading from that and remembering the list of Ishmael's sons that we got at the end of the previous Torah portion, the world would look at it, it just doesn't quite look all that successful, does it? No, as a matter of fact, it looks like this thing that the Lord is trying to do is not working out so well. And this is going to have an impact on Esau later on. We're going to talk about this impact that the appearances of the world has on Esau, on the flesh. You know, Esau represents the beast and he represents the field and he represents our flesh and how we view things, because we see that Ishmael has 12 sons and Isaac has only 2. And at this point, Isaac doesn't have any in these first 2 verses of the Torah portion. So, Esau is going to make a decision later on in his life that is going to show what kind of a man he was. That he was a man that had earthly desires and that he was willing to do anything that was necessary to get those earthly desires satisfied, because the earthly man cannot see the Father's hand. You know, unless the Father's hand is in this, it's not going to work. It's going to fail. However, the Lord is going to show us that He does do miracles so that we will learn to live by His words and our faith, and not by what we see, like Esau did. Now in verse 21, "And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived." Yeshua also entreats the Lord for us. You see, Isaac went on behalf of his wife that was barren. And you do realize that his wife, Yeshua's wife, right now is barren. Yes, we've seen people come to the Lord for the last 2,000 years and so forth. But what I mean about her being barren is that she has not yet given birth to Revelation's man-child, that kingdom that has to be birthed. You see, we're still barren in that regard. And so just like Isaac entreating the Lord for his wife, Yeshua entreats for us. How does he do that? Well, he entreats the Lord by making intercession for us. In Isaiah 53:12, it says, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he has poured out his soul to death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors." Romans 8:34 says, "Who is he that condemns? It is Messiah that died, yea, rather, that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God making intercession for us." And Hebrews 7:25, "Therefore he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come to God by him, seeing that he just ever lives to make intercession for them." So that's exactly what the example of Isaac doing here in verse 21 that Yeshua is doing for us. And of course it says the Lord was entreated of him, meaning the Lord responded to him, you see. And so Isaac had to ask for that promise. You see, he had to entreat. Now, why does Yeshua have to ask? Because he is waiting for the Father to give permission for him to set up the kingdom. Remember, Yeshua told the disciples that only the Father has the authority to say when this kingdom will begin. So Yeshua entreats on our behalf, making intercession for us so that we can be prepared to give birth to the man-child, the kingdom, and be able to set up his kingdom on the earth. In other words, to bring forth Jacob, the Jacob kingdom, the house of Jacob in the restoration. And at the same time that the Jacob nation, or that the house of Jacob, is in the process of being restored, Esau is also being born, and that means the Great Tribulation. That's the whole crux of the tribulation right there. And so, Hasatan brings forth Esau's kingdom, and Yeshua brings forth Jacob's kingdom. And in verse 22, we get a picture of this, because it says, "The children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If it be so, why am I thus?' And she went to inquire of the Lord." So we're going to talk about this a little bit, because she's inquiring of the Lord. And one of the things we need to understand when we inquire of the Lord is that we need to be ready to deal with the answers that he gives us. And sometimes he gives us an answer that we really don't understand the entire parameters of. We don't understand the whole situation. And especially regarding the promise of his kingdom, because in his coming, there must first be a great struggle in the cosmic womb of the woman who is going to give birth to the man-child that Satan chases. See? And so we have to be ready to go through this struggle. Now, we think of the struggle as being the Great Tribulation, but I dare say that I think the Lord's people are in great struggle Right now, we're struggling individually, we're struggling with each other, and we're struggling with the Lord, and then here comes the great tribulation, which is the struggle between Jacob and Esau on top of all that. And now you've got the ingredients for the coming kingdom. So when the Father has determined that we are ready, just like he did for Rebecca, he's going to tell us about the struggle that's going on, that there are two nations trying to be born. During the Great Tribulation, the nations that are trying to be born are Esau and Jacob. You see, one is of the Father and one is of the enemy. And so each represents, Esau and Jacob each represent a kingdom. In Matthew 24 verse 7, it says, "For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places." So what Matthew 24 is detailing for us is the struggle of the unborn infants. Nation against nation means man-made countries warring against each other. And we're seeing that right now in the Middle East. Everything that is happening in the Middle East has to do with what the UN did decades ago. In fact, almost 100 years ago, starting with the British Empire defeating the Ottoman Empire and beginning to dismantle the Ottoman Empire, and then the creation of borders that are not natural borders according to the way these people lived for 4,000 years. So it has caused nation to be against nation. And by the way, Israel, the political state of Israel, is a man-made state. It is, I call it the political state of Israel, because it does not encompass all of what Israel will be when Yeshua comes. But now when the verse there says kingdom against kingdom, it means the struggle between two rival spiritual realms, you see? And those are represented by Satan and Yeshua. Now, Esau and Jacob represent represents the two kinds of nations on the earth at the time of the end time struggle. They represent the nations, but they also represent the greater struggle going on between Satan and Yeshua. So Esau and Jacob represent both nations and kingdoms warring against each other. Verse 23, "The Lord said, two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." Now I want to take a look at the word two nations there, because that is Strong's 1471, and it's goy. And it's from it's a sense of a foreign nation, a Gentile nation, used normally in the scriptures. But we do know that Jacob is not a Gentile nation. So this has to do with two kinds of nations, Esau and Jacob, Gentiles and Hebrews. You see what I'm saying? Now the word for kingdom is Strong's 4467, and that is mamlaka, and it means the dominion. It also can mean the country, but it is used for kingdom and a king and the king's reign and the royalty. Now in verse 24 it says, "When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb." And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And now this time, when her days to be delivered are fulfilled, in other words, when all the prophecies regarding that time have been fulfilled, and when it is time to give birth, there will have been twins in the womb, but only one of them is going to live. We have in the scriptures in the book of Obadiah, the entire book, one chapter, is dedicated to the destruction of the Edomites. And the reason for that is because the Lord is not going to put us through this same process again. One will live, one will be stronger, and the other will not live. Now, let me qualify this by saying that among the Edomites, there will be people who will come along with Yeshua, the Messiah, and they will be saved. Because, you know, in Deuteronomy it says, do not hate an Edomite, for he is your brother. And we have the understanding that Esau usurped the house of Ishmael, and that there will be Ishmaelites, you know, who were former Ishmaelites that will be in the kingdom, and they will come upon the altar with approval. And so, primarily, those that will be destroyed are those who are Edomites in spirit. It isn't everybody who has an Edomite ancestor, because that could be any of us. Everybody who is willing to make a covenant and be in Jacob's kingdom through the Messiah will be saved and will be in the kingdom. But rest assured that those Edomites that want to remain Edomites will not be allowed to continue living. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. So there we have the 6,000 years, 40 years of testing. Then she conceives. Then there's 2,000 years while they're struggling in the womb. And then the Great Tribulation is the actual birth process. Do you see that? Isaac was 60 years old when she had the children, but he was 40 years old when he married her. So the 4,000 years is the time of testing, and the 2,000 years is, I guess, a time of testing, yes, because they're struggling within her womb. And for a while it looked like the Catholic Church was going to win this thing, even though there was a Protestant movement that are, you know, those people are still protesting the Catholic indulgences, but they didn't protest any of the other things that are wrong with the Catholic doctrine. It looked like for 2,000 years that was going to win, but guess what? There are people now who understand the difference, and now that we're getting toward the end of this thing, they are the ones who are exhibiting the spiritual maturity to know that if you want to express your faith and show your love for the Lord, that you keep the Torah, unlike what the Catholic Church and its doctrines handed down for the past almost 2,000 years. So you see that that was a struggle, because the Catholic Church is actually an Edomite organization. And so it looked like Edom was, and Esau was going to get the upper hand. But we now know that that's not the case, because Jacob's hand was on Esau's heel. Our hand, the Hebrew roots, messianic community, the ones that understand about this relationship with the Lord now at the end of days, our hand is on that heel of the Catholic Church, the way that Jacob's hand was on Esau's heel. See, that's what that means. The hand on the heel has many connotations, not the least of which is the prophetic indication of it being at the end. And verse 27 says, "The boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter and a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob." So now we're talking about the character of the flesh and the spiritual appetites. In this instance, Isaac represents the appetite of the flesh, and Rebekah represents the spiritual appetite. And then we have the story about when Esau came in from the field and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And then in chapter 26, then we have, the famine and Isaac going to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, for help, and the Lord telling him to not go down to Egypt and to dwell in the land there. So we have this, after Esau and Jacob are born, and after Esau sells his birthright to Jacob, we now have that they go down into the area of the Philistines, and the Lord says, don't go to Egypt, and so forth. Now, I want to go on, and I want to skip over, Isaac doing the same mistake as Abraham. I think, Teresa mentioned this to me last year, that it was interesting to her that Abraham and Isaac were not willing to lay down their life for their wife, but Yeshua was. Well, it goes to show you that a man is not able to give his life in the way that the Lord can give his life. And I think that that is kind of one of the overtones of this lesson about Isaac and Sarah and, I'm sorry, Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah. We see here a little bit of the character of being fearful and so forth, but I will say again, I don't want to hear people disparaging our ancestors in the way that makes these men out to be like the worst of the worst, because I have heard people say the accusation, for instance, that Esau labeled Jacob with, that he is a deceiver. And ministers standing in the pulpit and saying that Jacob is a deceiver, and saying that Isaac is a liar and a fearful man, saying that Abraham is a liar and a fearful man, and disparaging our forefathers this way. We are missing some context. We are missing compassion for them in their struggles. And we are missing that these particular instances don't characterize what they were throughout their lives. These character tales are there for us so that when we do things that, we do out of fear or anxiety or bad circumstances or whatever, that we can look back and say, our forefather went through that and he came out of that just fine and the Lord took care of him. That's what the real lesson should be. Not that we disparage these men. But now let's move on to Genesis 27, because I want to talk about this blessing that Isaac gave to his son. It's in this Torah portion that Isaac's character gets questioned the most, and Jacob's, and the accusation that Esau made, which was that Jacob is a deceiver. That was what Esau said. And if we agree with Esau, I've heard preachers get in the pulpit and agree with that, saying that Jacob was a deceiver. If we agree with that, we're agreeing with the enemy. And Rebekah's motivations and her character get sliced into little pieces. Well, let me see if I can help the thinking on that. Because we don't have all the information. We don't have the thoughts that were going through their minds. We don't know whether it is possible that Rebecca and Isaac were setting this up and working together. You know, the scripture in some ways seems to point that Isaac knew and was helping this process, and then in other ways it seems to go the other way, that he didn't know. And you know, but that probably isn't the point. The point is about Esau and his attitude toward his inheritance. First of all, he sold his birthright because he had cut off somebody's head and he thought he was going to die. That person was King Nimrod, who was the king of Babylon at the time. And so he thought he was going to die, so he comes running in when Jacob is making the red lentil stew of comfort, to comfort Isaac at the time that Abraham had died. That was Esau's place to be doing that for Isaac. You know, to be cooking that stew and comforting his father, rather than being out in the field beheading Nimrod and then running away from Nimrod's men like a coward, which is, as you know in my other teachings, one of the reasons why we're facing this Babylonian thing at the end of days, because Esau failed to take that throne. So we have to deal with that now. But he didn't do it, and instead he sold his birthright. But now, in this chapter, years later, here we are, now the firstborn blessing has to be bestowed. Now, in the world, the firstborn is usually the firstborn of the family. I mean, that's exactly how that happens. You're the firstborn, you get the double portion. That's the context of this Torah portion and the context of the culture in which they lived. And how that this was done is that they would count the number of children that were alive, and they would add one to the count. So when the father was dying, whoever was there around the bed for him at the time of his death, they would count and add one. And the firstborn would get his own, and he would get that extra inheritance. And then all the other children would, of course, get their portion of the inheritance. The purpose of the firstborn blessing was to be able to inherit the birthright. What is the birthright? The birthright is the land and the family wealth, and to be able to determine what happens to that land, because the firstborn has to make provision for the rest of the family. That's why he gets control of the estate, and it's why he gets control of the double portion. So he has to be of sufficient character that he wouldn't cut the rest of the family out of the estate. Well, the birthright had been sold. So now the question is, who's going to get the firstborn position? Because if Isaac gives that to Esau, then the birthright to Jacob is useless, because the firstborn controls the birthright. You see, he controls that estate. You can't really separate the birthright and the firstborn blessing, even though that was done with Jacob's sons, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but they have to go together. So Esau was a cunning hunter. In other words, when he was sitting there with Jacob over that bowl of red stew, he was thinking, I can sell this to him for this stew. If I die, then, you know, he's got the birthright. If I live, well, Daddy will give me the firstborn blessing later on down the road, and I'll still have the birthright. Esau had tried to swindle, he was trying to swindle Jacob out of the deal that he had made. And by the way, Jacob is the one that kept stepping up to do the right thing according to the way the Torah says that children are supposed to act toward their parents. Esau did not honor his parents. We're going to see this when he goes off and marries the Canaanite woman. That's in Genesis 36, verse 2. It says that Esau took his wives from the women of Canaan. Daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, daughter of Anah, and granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite. And you do know that sometimes the scriptures, they tell you the story, but they don't get it all in the right spot exactly. But in chapter 28 also, we learn that he did that. In verse 8, it says that Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father, then he went to Ishmael and took the wives which he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abram's son, the sister of Nebaioth, to be his wife. And he took her to his wives. So Esau had already demonstrated that the estate was going to go to the Canaanites. The wrong people were going to get the estate of Abraham, through whom the promised son came. And the promised son now has a duty to make sure that that estate does not go to the Canaanites through those two Canaanite women, because Esau was already married to these two women at the time of what was happening here in chapter 27. At this episode, Esau was already married to them. He had already demonstrated how much he despised the kingdom and the Lord and his parents and his brother Jacob and the Torah. But you do know that it wouldn't have mattered. He would have done what he wanted, and he would have cast Jacob out of the family and kept everything for himself. You do know that, right? So this man was a swindler and a liar and a man of the field. Jacob was a man of the tents. He was a Torah keeper. And he was honoring his father and his mother. So you see, there's a little bit different understanding that we need to get because of the cultural context of this. We need to understand what was going to happen if Jacob did not get the firstborn blessing. There's a spiritual principle about who gets the firstborn blessing. Starting with Noah's sons, the youngest son, Shem, got the firstborn blessing. Then we have Abraham. The scriptures doesn't say, but if you do a study, you'll find out that it was likely that Abraham was the youngest, that Haran was the oldest, and Nahor was the next one, and then came Abraham. But it was Abraham that got the call to leave Haran in Syria and go to Canaan after Terah died, because Abraham was given the firstborn birthright and the firstborn blessing, which is the Lord's kingdom, where he's going to set up his kingdom, that area that we on the map now refer to as Greater Israel. That area was given to Abraham as the birthright and as the firstborn blessing. Then we have Abraham's two sons. The youngest son, the second son, gets the firstborn blessing and the birthright. It does not go to Ishmael. It goes to Isaac. The firstborn blessing and the birthright stay together in Isaac. Then we have Isaac's two sons. The second son gets the firstborn blessing because the birthright had been sold to him, and the birthright and the firstborn blessing need to stay together. Later on, we're going to see that it isn't the first or the second or the third son of Jacob that gets the firstborn blessing. It will be Judah, the fourth son. But in the case of the house of Joseph, he actually gets the birthright. Let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, start at verse 1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. And the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler, but the birthright was Joseph's. What does that mean? Well, there's a whole lot in there. But first, it shows us that the one with the firstborn blessing becomes the ruler, which is what Esau wanted, and it's an example of how the birthright and the firstborn blessing can be divided. See, Judah got the firstborn blessing, so he got the job of rulership and having the care and consideration for his brethren, but the inheritance, the birthright, belongs to Joseph. And what that has done, that's part of the critical factor in splitting the two houses. You see, the 10 northern tribes all got together under the auspices of a descendant of Ephraim, the firstborn of Joseph, who actually was the youngest. Here again, we repeat this pattern of it doesn't go through the firstborn, the first physical child, because Ephraim was younger and he was chosen by Jacob to follow this spiritual pattern. So Jeroboam was Ephraim's descendant, and so the other tribes followed him because they understood that the firstborn blessing and the birthright had been split, because they believed that they had that right to be the head of the kingdom. And Judah was already in control because he has to oversee and take care of the family. So you see how that just didn't work out too good, right? But in the kingdom, in Yeshua's kingdom, it will work out well, because Joseph and Judah will be restored and the Messiah will rule over both of them. The Messiah will then have the firstborn blessing and the birthright in his possession. And so that's how the kingdom gets restored. So you can see how it's important for the blessing and the birthright to go together. So if Esau had been allowed to get that birthright back, to go, you know, hand in hand with that firstborn blessing that Isaac was giving to Jacob, the kingdom would never have been able to be established. It would have been a kingdom, it would have become a kingdom based on fleshly desires rather than on heavenly desires. And I fully believe that Isaac was afraid of Esau. I believe that's why the scriptures there are so ambiguous, that they let you think in one place that he did know what he was doing, and in another place that he did not. I think it was for the purpose of that he would have an excuse in front of Esau. Now, there are going to be people who will say, well, perfect love casts out fear, and so Isaac was operating under fear. Well, yeah, he was operating under fear. He operated under fear like Abraham when it came to their wives being taken from them or the possibility of losing their lives and having to lay down their lives for their wives. I've talked about that a little bit earlier. I want to address this thing about love casting out fear. Okay, let's go to 1 John chapter 4 where this teaching is. And let's read about it in the International Standard Version. Let's look at the context of this whole chapter. The reason we're going to look at the context of it is because I'm going to just say that we have in the Hebrew Roots community Christian baggage. And one of our Christian baggages is the propensity and the glee with which some Christian Bible teachers like to take a scripture out of context without understanding the cultural context, without understanding the scriptures around it, and even the chapters around it, and even the book that it's written in, and who the author is, without understanding what things like this mean in other places in the scripture. In other words, there's a lack of perspicuity, perspicuity where it agrees from the beginning to the end. They like to take these out of context. I can't tell you how many times I've been criticized for expressing having a fear. Well, let's go and look at the context of this chapter. It's talking here about loving one another and how the Lord loved us, and because he loved us, we are able to love one another unconditionally. And we don't have this yet in the Hebrew Roots community where we love each other unconditionally, you know, whether somebody agrees with us or not, or you know what I mean, that kind of love. But that's what it's talking about. This is love being perfected among us. See? Why? Let's go look at 1 John chapter 4, verse 17. This is how love has been perfected among us. How is that? Well, in the beginning of the chapter and down to verse 16, it talks about the Lord's relationship of love with us, and that we need to love one another the way the Lord loves us. And it says here, this is how love has been perfected among us. We will have confidence on the day of judgment. Because during our time in this world, we are just like him. There is no fear where love exists, rather. Perfect love banishes, or casts out in the King James, fear. Perfect love banishes fear. For fear involves punishment, and the person who lives in fear has not been perfected in love. What does that mean? Well, two things. It means that you don't trust the Lord, and that you have not exhibited the Lord's love that he has for you to other people. Therefore, that's this kind of fear. This is not the kind of fear where you are right in fearing for your life the way that I believe Isaac was fearing for his life. He sent him out. Isaac sent Esau out to the field in order to give him time to give this blessing to Jacob. In those days, It was the Father, when he died, when he was on his deathbed, that he had the right to designate any child in the family as the firstborn, to give that one the firstborn blessing and the birthright. So if he had done that with Esau in the room, do you think Esau would have just stood there and took that? No. So I believe the ambiguity there in this chapter has to do with it is a hint to us of the turmoil that was going on inside of Isaac, because he loved Esau, but he couldn't give him this firstborn blessing, especially knowing that Esau had despised his birthright. And so, do you not think that Rebekah had told Isaac what the Lord said to her, that the younger is to rule over and to be stronger than the oldest? The younger is to have that. So that's what it is. When you get the birthright and the firstborn blessing, that's the one who rules over the others in the family. That's what the Lord was talking about there with Rebekah. So this chapter is ambiguous because it's telling us that there's turmoil in Isaac. Fear of his own son. So we need to be kind in our perspective of Isaac and not say that he was not right in the head, as I've heard, or that he would have given Esau the blessing, because he wouldn't have. He entreated the Lord for Rebekah, and when Rebekah conceived and was bearing those children, she consulted with the Lord. She entreated the Lord, and she would have told Isaac what the Lord said. They already knew the answer. They probably did not know why when those two babies were born, but they knew the answer. And as those two boys grew into men and began to live their lives, they both could see that one was walking away from the Lord and the other was walking with the Lord. And knowing that he was the promised son and through him was to be the Messiah, do you think Isaac really was going to let Esau get that firstborn blessing and be able to divide the family or to get that birthright back from Jacob by killing Jacob or by banishing him and giving this inheritance to the Canaanites? No, I don't believe that's true at all. The Lord has set up a pattern here to show us that it doesn't go by your physical placement in the family. It goes by whether or not you are willing to honor your parents, whether you're willing to study the Torah, and those kinds of things. And so I hope that this has given you a different perspective on why Jacob and Rebekah and Isaac conspired to make this happen, and why I believe it was correct and completely justifiable, because they knew that it would be all over if Esau got this blessing. We need to understand which family we're in so that we can start to defend the family that we're in. Jacob absolutely did the right thing by obeying Rebekah. And Rebekah absolutely did the right thing. And Isaac did the right thing because I believe that on the side of that he understood what was going on. He understood that that was Jacob's voice, but that he had a way out of the trouble that was going to come from Esau. So let us not disparage Isaac for having this fear of Esau, because Esau had already destroyed everything that the family was about. He had just walked all over and walked away from everything that his father, Isaac, had tried to teach him. So, anyway, I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.